Good morning, my name is Willem Carver, and I represent the Northern Cape Province.
Morning, Chair. My name is Boimot Lontezo. I'm part of the committee. Good morning, my name is Jacques Lont, and I represent the Western Cape on the Select Committee.
Good morning, I'm Mr. Rasmus of Parliament.
Good morning, my name is Dolisa, I'm the PA to Honourable Martin.
Morning everybody, Ismail Hussain from PMG.
Good morning, Abdullah Khani for the Research Report, thank you.
Can we give you an opportunity please to introduce yourselves from NCC? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson and Honourable Members. I am Kezi Mabuza. I am the acting commissioner for today, and I am assisted by two colleagues here. That's Mr. Fanel Merve, who is our acting chief financial officer, which is our head corporate services. And then we also have our other chief director, who is the head of governance. And then there's also an apology that we would want to render from... Oh, that's Mr. Kulges, head governance. Kulges.
K-U-L-J-E-E-T-S.
And we would want to render an apology on behalf of our commissioner, Mr. Mohammed. He is on sick leave, just undergone a procedure, medical procedure.
My name is George Nando. I'm the Parliamentary Liaison Officer.
Morning, the Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. My name is Nondombi Matomela. I represent the DTI.
Thank you very much. I'm sure our officials from NCC would not mind. I miscalculated. I didn't recognize that the two members are from the same province. You don't mind that we deal with the minutes quickly. Thank you. There we have the minutes, Honourable Members. Let's look at the minutes of the 16th of May. That's when we had the National Department of Tourism presenting its strategic plan and budget to us. The members that were present, it's listed on the first page. We had an apology from the Honourable Dikhale only on that day. Then we look at the committee comments and deliberations. I've looked at them. There are no controversies in that. Then we have the resolution that we accepted the Department of Tourism annual performance plan and budget. And then we adopted the minutes of the meeting that was held on the 17th of April. Can I get a proposal for acceptance of that, the Honourable Faber?
I second.
Honourable Ntebe seconds. Thanks very much. We've dealt with that one. And then, Honourable Members, the meeting of the 30th of May. I've said to Chupeka before, I'm not an editor. So he sent me this minute beforehand. I was not in the meeting on that day. But you'll notice on page 1. The question marks there. So it's the Honourable M. Khai and it's the Honourable Mahuebo V. That is the only corrections that I would want to propose to that. Honourable Faber?
Just again on our member of the EFF, there's apology. But that was also, she was still not ATC. So we take the apology even though she's not ATC to be part of the committee? I just need to understand that.
Because it's not such serious a legal matter and she did render an apology, you see, the problem is in some minutes she'll be recorded as a member and in other minutes not. So I thought because she has done her, she has met her responsibility. Let's keep it as it is.
Yeah.
Okay. with that done, then, are we happy to propose the adoption of that minute? Honorable Tikhale, Honorable Father. Honorable Tikhale, thanks also very much for taking responsibility to chair that meeting for us. Honorable members, some of you might know that my wife fractured her femur last week, Monday. I had to rush her to hospital. She was operated on last week, Tuesday. And by last week, Wednesday, strong African woman, she was walking already. Yesterday, the therapist went around to the house to also help her so that she can regain the full use of her left leg. The specialist said to me that breaking a femur in that way is what they call a pathological fracture, which is a lie. It cannot happen, but it happened. But thank you also very much for your support and prayers on that. That done, can I then hand over to you, please, Ms. Mabusa.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you, Honorable Members, for the opportunity that you've given us to come and present to you our strategic and annual performance plan. Our outline in terms of the presentation, it will cover the overview of the strategy, our annual performance plan supported by the financial chair. The vision of the emphasis is actually to be a professional, responsible, and effective institution. And we do this by making sure that we promote compliance with the Consumer Protection Act. And this is through advocacy and enforcement. We ensure that our fair business practices are upheld to the sense of social and economic welfare of our consumers. In terms of our value statement, we know that the consumers that normally come to the embassy are actually at the wrong end. And what we do, we try to be professional and ethical. In doing that, we try as well with the resources that we have to be efficient and effective. But as well, when we come to decisions that we make, we try to be transparent in the manner in which we would be giving them those decisions by being accountable. But because we are also a small institution, we work in teams in such a way that we foster teamwork within our work streams. In terms of the legislative mandate, as you know that the NCC is a creature of statute. We are created by Section 85 of the Consumer Protection Act. We report to the Department of Trade and Industry, but then the entity that we report to as a unit is the one of Consumer and Corporate Regulation Division. And then the key role of that division is to ensure that there is credible institutions of enforcement within the marketplace. And our responsibility as the entity is to enforce and carry out functions assigned to us in terms of Section 85 of the Act. And amongst those, is that the Act is an Act of General Application which sets your norms and standards in relation to consumer protection. It also provides for improved standards of consumer information throughout the country in such a way that whatever standards that the Act puts in, it becomes the norm for everybody in any other transaction, could it be a private entity, could it be government or itself. And also the Act, what it does, it also prohibits unfair marketing practices and unfair business practices. This we do by when you look at the manner in which you would be going, you're getting your SMSs through your phones and all that, those that are ethical in giving in curfews for the time that you would be given marketing information. And it also looks at protecting unfair, deceptive conduct by suppliers. You would see that goes to the same, like when you're looking at those drinks wherein people would be alleging that a slimming mixture would be making you thin within 2 days and all that. That is what we call deceptive practices. But then it also promotes responsible consumer behavior. We know that sometimes what our consumers would do is they will know, we know that they will be unfairly treated, but sometimes there will be certain practices wherein they want to be unduly enriched, wherein somebody will break their eyes and then expect that a supplier will replace that. That is the unfair consumer behavior that we'll be looking at, that we address through this Act as well. But the Act as well promotes consistent legislative and enforcement frameworks relating to transactions. This, in terms of consistent legislation, is that for any other legislation in the country that we have, could it be within a province, could it be by a department, it has to be consistent with the principles of the Consumer Protection Act. In terms of also the delivery, I'm on slide 6, is that consumer protection is an integral part of our just market as we are right now in the modern society. In such a way that what the DTI looks at is that when you are looking at the fairness in the market and the quality that consumers are supposed to expect, is that by itself it improves competitiveness because it forces your suppliers to ensure that whatever quality they give to the consumers has to be on par to meet the consumer needs, but in turn as well, it elevates what the industry will produce so that they become competitive in the market. The intention of the DTI with the Act itself was to ensure that there is culture of consumer rights and then that also there is responsibility in the market that has to prevail, because when you foster that right, what normally happens is that the business itself and consumers learn to stand by themselves when they know they are right. And then that equality in terms of the force that the market has compared to what the consumers have now becomes a little bit kind of like balance. It also creates the confidence in consumers that is important in driving competitiveness, as we spoke about the culture before. But what also the Act does is that it enforces, it assists in regulating the conduct of suppliers of goods and services to consumers, because now they also have to adhere by quality and good, safe products. In this environment as well, is that South Africa, when we're looking at the legislation that we have, that we are enforcing right now, is that we are on par with our national counterparts or international counterparts. But when you are looking at standards of the region and also in Africa, we are amongst the leading countries when it comes to consumer protection. But then while as well, while I was listening to the MPs, is that we are all representing provinces, but then when you're looking at consumer protection, it's not only the responsibility of the National Commission, it's also a concurrent responsibility with our provinces, wherein we still have our 9 provincial authorities that as well have a mandate within transactions that happen within their provinces, that they have to ensure that they also put their part but still using the Consumer Protection Act as an act, which is a general act, that also becomes their norm so that we have uniformity within the different provinces. When you are looking at the NCC and the alignment of our strategy with its legislative mandate, is that we ensure that there is conciliation and mediation in the resolution of consumer complaints that is promoted. As you see that while we have the 9 provinces, the role of the NCC is to ensure that there's a link between the different provinces and national government and also our the Ombuds scheme, so that there is actually that platform that is fair, that is uniform, that we have to ensure that that mechanism works. And then the minister as such has assisted the NCC by making sure that when we propose to him the 2 Ombuds schemes that we have within the motor industry and the consumer goods and services, he has approved that to ensure that those alternative dispute resolution agents, what we call the Ombuds, they are working in support so that they push on the mandate of conciliation and mediation. The NCC's key focus, besides just putting in place the platform for mediation and conciliation of complaints, is to make sure that we dwell much on the investigation of prohibited conduct. But then, even if it's like that, which is our core function, is that we cannot, as the NCC, investigate each and every complaint, given the minimum resources that we have in the country. But what we also do is when we do the investigation, we look at matters that are systemic. In being systemic, what we will do is when we get a complaint or a number of complaints, we would look at the thread. Let's say we get like the case in point when you were looking at the issues of the Ford Cougar. You will see that the cars were burning, but then what we wanted to look at, it was a threat as to was there a prohibited conduct. Even if they will resolve the issue of the complaint, we will still go ahead and investigate because we wanted to know in terms of the conduct of the supplier, were they, in terms of the manner in which they were providing the cars, were they actually acting inconsistent in providing unsafe or poor quality goods? That's the kind of systems that we're talking about when we say that matters are systemic. It's wherein we find a threat which is prohibited and that forces us actually to act against the supplier. But then another priority of the emphasis is to ensure that consumers are supplied with reliable services, goods and services, and that the consumer's health is, and their life is protected, including to making sure that we have sustainable consumption. A case in matter would be your listeria, but then there are also a lot of other matters that we'll talk to, like the issues of your airbags, the issues of your Kellogg's, your juices and all that, that would normally do. This is actually wherein we're looking at your product recalls, wherein sometimes you would not see that some of the matters might not be in the radar. But what normally happens is if there is a weakness in the market, let's say a particular good is released to the market, and then there is a weakness that is being picked up, let's say, like with the issues of your Rice Krispies, where in the machine just broke, and there were metals in the product. What the supplier will do is will inform the NCC, will allow them to give us a strategy on how they will recall a particular product. We will monitor that product to ensure that the entire consignment is being removed from the market. Consumers that have bought that product, they are compensated, and then as well to ensure that now they'll give us assurance that they will look into the quality to ensure that that doesn't happen. When we do that, we work in conjunction with other regulators, like your national regulator for compulsory specifications when it comes to issues of airbags on engines. We would work with the South African Bureau of Standards when it comes to your conformity standards. We would work with the Department of Agriculture when it comes to goods that are imported into the country to ensure that we have the same consignments that are being reported. And then also the Department of Health. You would see that was actually more prominent when you looked at the issues of listeria and all that in terms of that symbiotic relationship with other regulators. And then when you're looking at also the structures or the support that we have to carry our mandate, at the NCC, we have a funded position of 85, a funded position. This is versus the 182 positions that when the NCC was established, it's what was done to make sure that we carry out our mandate. But given the constraint in the fiscal, we only could fund with the 55.8 million that we have, we could only fund 85 positions, and that 85 positions still carries 78% of our entire budget. So that leaves us with only 22% to actually deal with our overhead costs and also with a new project. And as such, because of the constraint in the budget, we have kept our salary benefits to be within that of the public service, even if we are outside the public service itself. Our members are members of the government employee pension fund, and this was thanks to our change when we moved from the DTI, we can still maintain being part of the government employee pension fund. But we could not get our members to be part of the government employee pension fund of the medical scheme because we are outside the public service. We still within what we have, we are using it, we're using the scales of the public service. We actually do not negotiate our salaries. We wait for the public service central bargaining council to announce their increments in relation to the cost of living expenses for the salary level 1 to 12, and we also adopted that for our senior management. And then in terms of our corporate services that we are directed in terms of using our processes and systems that are actually part of the public service, and then we are hold into, held into account by public service, the public finance management. But then we also had a recognition agreement with NIHAU, and now what the department is doing in supporting us is that the department is setting up a collective bargaining council for us, all the entities of the DTI, that will start next year. But for this year, we are still using the system that we have of looking at the salaries in terms of the bargaining council in the public sector. The emphasis in managing its finances in terms of corporate governance, we have our internal risk management committee, and then we are assisted by an audit and risk management committee, which is made up of a ex officio of the DTI, Ms. Matumela is here, but then all our audit and risk committee members, they are external members that we appoint every 3 years. And then the risk management processes is integral to our corporate governance, so that we're looking at our risk management strategy, we implement, we check that, and we ensure that we report that to the audit and the risk management committee. But what we had done is we had outsourced our internal audit function, because looking at the resources that we have, we wanted people that are more qualified to assist us and look inward looking to assist us, so that we can actually draw up a 3-year rolling strategic plan with them, ask them to audit us on certain functions, report to our audit and risk committee, and so that we have also that link between internal audit and also the reliance by our auditor general's offices. So we report, as we say, to our audit and risk management committee quarterly, both our risk and our internal audit. So the internal audits assist us in maintaining an efficient and effective controls by evaluating those controls to ensure that we improve. And then wherein we have weaknesses in terms of internal audits, point the weaknesses, so that come the time of the final audit by AG, that we are with at least mitigated some of the weaknesses in terms of our checks and balances and the controls. And we also have a fraud prevention plan in place that assists us to track if maybe there are no incidences of fraud within our system. In terms of our strategic outcomes, in considering our strategic outcomes, we looked at our legislative mandate and the environment in which we operate. And then we ensure that the organization is up to date with its organizational performance. And when we look at our challenges as well, we cater for that through our risk mitigating strategy. We've also given consideration to political, economic, and our social environment, and also issues of the impact that the advancement in technology has in relation to the performance or areas of operation within the entity. We were also able to define our critical strategic tasks within the next coming 5 years. That is what we try to do to ensure that we are on par with the challenges in terms of also gearing ourselves in terms of skills and the challenges that we have, because we are working in a constantly changing environment, especially when you're looking at businesses and issues of connectivity within the environment in which we operate. We have three strategic outcomes, and the first one is around consumer protection and consumer safety. This outcome, normally it's, we have two of our divisions working around that, is the division around our legal and also our enforcement and investigation. This actually is one of the biggest chunk of our area of delivery, because it talks to the environment wherein we deal with issues of resolution of consumer complaints, wherein we will receive complaints from the public. And then in this instance, either forward those complaints to our alternative dispute resolution agents, and also some to provinces, and some would also deal with them ourselves, like within your cell phone industry and all that. We would also look at those investigations, at those complaints, and suss out matters of prohibited conduct that will guide the number of investigations that we would have to conduct through our screening committee. And then we'll also look at applications. After we have conducted an investigation, then we will see that if it becomes a prohibited conduct and we want to bring this matter towards the tribunal, we become those persons who then take the matter to the tribunal, wherein they will sit and arbitrate against us like in any other court, and then from there we'll get a finding against companies. And we will also, as I said before, around product recalls when there are weaknesses within products in terms of goods that we have in the market, we will also facilitate and do monitor product recalls within the second outcome here is to promote reform of consumer policy and compliance within consumer protection. This is actually what we do through our legal division. What happens here in these programs is that, as we said, that our act becomes a norm for all other transactions in the country. You will realize that when we are looking out, just give an example, like when we were dealing with issues of data and issues of CASA, we were looking at the rollout or the rollout of data and the expiry of our vouchers within 3 years. This, what we had picked up, is that the principles that were applied within the ICASA Act were against the principle of the Consumer Protection Act, where in the voucher, in the interpretation of the other act, once it becomes activated, then that 1 month or that 2 months, depending on what the supplier could say, it will expire. But then it was against the spirit of the Consumer Protection Act. In incidences like that, we will identify that legislation, analyze it, and approach the minister and say to the minister, in this act, we see that consumers are being shortchanged because the principles are not consistent with the spirit of the act. Then we will now get our ministry, the Department of Trade and Industry, to look into regulation and say, how do we now ensure that there is consistency between the two legislations? And sometimes we'll also look at practices within that and say that if the practice within a particular industry goes against the grain of the CPA, then we will now engage with the relevant department and say, given the legislation that you have within this practice, let's say, of the issue of providing water, maybe by the municipalities to ensure that it may be the pricing of water and all that prohibits or becomes too prohibitive for other sectors of the economy, then we will point that to the minister so that he engages with the relevant ministry as well to make sure that the spirit of the Consumer Protection Act permeates throughout all our services within South Africa. The third outcome here is to promote public awareness and consumer protection. This we do through our advocacy division, the research and advocacy division. We will do this by facilitating workshops and business focused workshops. In this instance, what we have looked at is that some of our consumers, they would not actually complain because they don't know what is their right. It's still critical for us in South Africa to make sure that consumers understand what are their rights and how to go about complaining, hence the consumer workshop. But we also have seen that within the curriculum in schools as well, is that the school curriculum for your grade 6 and your grade 7 covers consumer protection. What we have done is we are working with the provinces and also with some of the schools to ensure that we take the curriculum itself and make it alive by creating what we call consumer class in the primary schools, where we engage certain schools, especially within the rural areas, with the educators as well, so that we make the curriculum to be alive, for the kids to know their rights, and we make them consumer conscious within their schools. But also we produce quarterly newsletters. That becomes more of a source document for our consumers and also for the businesses. And for the businesses, we realize that not all businesses, with the bigger businesses, which are your chain markets, like when you look at their likes of your Pick and Pay, your Spas, and your Checkers, we don't have a problem with that in terms of the policies. But we have a problem with our smaller, self-single-standing businesses, wherein for them, issues of regulation become substantive because they don't understand what are their obligations on issues of returns and all that, but also around the foreign nationals wherein you will find that they don't understand it, where you still see that sign that says no refund, no replacement and all that. So we try to work with business formations of the different cultures to make sure that they understand what the act requires of them and then assist them to make sure that they comply. And those are the three strategic outcomes that we will be carrying throughout. But then when it comes to issues of now our strategic focus, this actually is incremental for, though it's for 2018-19, but then we are carrying them through also for 20, up to the outer years, up to 2019-20 and 2021 as such. The first outcomes that we have is around facilitating an environment that enables resolution of dispute, that allows resolution of disputes between your consumers and your suppliers so that it becomes cost-effective, fair, and transparent. We are looking at two outcomes here, which is your consumer complaints that are processed timely, and then also the accreditation. We're continuously looking at accreditation of ombuds schemes here. Is that continuously when we're looking at complaints that we have. As you know that for now we only have two ombuds schemes that we have, the one for the motor vehicles and the one for the fast moving goods. Is that when we analyze complaints, we will see that in this area we would need somebody that is dedicated within that particular business that will be able to look only at matters relating to a specific sector. And in this instance, continuously would engage businesses or business formations, or sometimes they would approach us and say, you know, we looked at, as an association, we looked at our consumer complaints and said that maybe we need a code that will talk to a practice within any particular sector. We will work with them, come up with a scheme where it will give them some kind of like comfort to become an alternative. They do not become a regulator. They become an alternative dispute resolution agent only for that sector to assist us in facilitating the resolution of the complaints. And if they fail, then still those complaints will come to us to investigate. So that is what we do with that first outcome there. And then the second outcome, as we're talking about, is around the investigation of conduct to ensure that when there is prohibited conduct, then we can take that further on. That's where in we're looking at those systemic issues, then conduct an investigation. Because our regulation is still young, we now struggle between looking at what is systemic, and sometimes we would look at a principle. In this principle, we would be maybe looking at testing a principle. I'll just give an analogy of a second-hand vehicle. If somebody was buying a second-hand vehicle, the Act says that there should be a disclosure of defects. Now we haven't tested what is a disclosure and how far should a supplier disclose. Now, when we're looking at now the complaints that we have around second-hand vehicles, you will see that people will be saying that the car is old, it has done 80,000 kilometers, and they know that it will break at any other time. But the Act says that disclose to a consumer and say the car has been maybe involved in a collision front head, that would mean that either the gasket or maybe your radiator has been replaced. And then there not issues of wear and tear like your brake. And the coolant has been replaced, and then this has been replaced. So that the consumer, when the consumer transacts, then he knows exactly what they are up for. But then when the Act says that they should disclose, it doesn't say how much and how. So when we're looking at some of the consumer complaints, we'll just pick up one complaint and say, on this complaint, we want to test only the principle of disclosure. We will take this complaint as it is. It won't be four or three, but it will only be one. Investigate it and take it to the tribunal to make the tribunal pronounce so that we get a case law. When we get a case law, when now our provincial authorities now have a similar matter, they will refer to the finding in sample of the tribunal wherein they will be sent to the supplier. If such a matter happens, look at the ruling. It makes it easier now for both businesses to know that if I don't do A, B, and C, because it's already declared a prohibited conduct, it makes it easier now for both parties to negotiate within the terms of those findings. So this is what we do with our investigations. And this also talks to now when we say we make applications to the tribunal. When we have investigated, we approach the tribunal for them to enforce a particular prohibited conduct. And we also, as we said as well, on number five, we will administer and monitor product recalls. So that is what we do, and I've spoken, I think I've actually amplified that earlier as well. The other goal that we have here is where it talks to outcome number, output number six, where in we would actually now look, identify legislation that affects the welfare of consumers, and then we, what we do here is where in now we're looking at that consistency, as I said, like with the CASA Act, and also with the provision of water, where in now we'll be looking at practice, we look into a practice and say to consumer, this practice or this act goes against the ambit of the Consumer Protection Act, then we would now make a recommendation to the minister to either maybe look at the legislation or maybe sometimes from the DGI come up with norms and standards that will assist us to communicate and make sure that either the practice with the engagement of the provincial authorities or with a particular regulator, we can either as well correct this. And sometimes what we also do, that is your output number seven, we also issue explanatory notes and non-binding opinions. It happens sometimes that you will get consumers that don't know exactly where they stand with a certain practice. One that I would give, it was around the issue of the drive your car for $6.99. What you will see is that that was actually a practice that people would go in and get a car, but then there were the contract said that they will only pay $6.99, but it had a proviso to say on condition you drive so many mileage. But then the consumer did not understand that the contract itself that they had signed, it was a credit contract. Now when they come to us with such complaints, we will now look at the complaint and now advise the consumer to say that this contract that you signed is a credit contract, and in this instance, you are not a consumer because you said that you will drive and somebody will pay you to supplement the cost of actually your mortgage, or maybe the supplement the cost that you will pay to a bank, because if you drive 1,000, the advertiser will pay you a particular amount that actually supplements what you're supposed to be paying to the bank. So it's those kind of explanatory notes that we will give to consumers, and also sometimes to suppliers when they want to put their goods in the market, when they are talking around issues of disclosure and all that. So that is those kind of notes that we are saying here, which we call explanatory notes. We also sometimes apply for declaratory. As we're saying, sometimes when you're looking at number eight, that application for declaratory, we don't make it a scholarly where it will take the provision of the act and go to a court and say, we want you to declare whether this is prohibited and all that. We take a conduct which might be problematic, and then what we do is we investigate that, go to the tribunal for the tribunal to test that as such. And one such matter that became a declaratory as well for us, I think maybe members would also know about that. We had a case with the timeshare, wherein we wanted to take a matter, we took a matter to the tribunal, and then we realized that based on the gravity of that matter, that we would not succeed if we take it that way. We withdrew the matter, and what happened is the industry itself took us to court. They won in the High Court to actually get costs against the NCC. What he said is that we were applying for this to actually get the matter tested at the tribunal on behalf of the consumer. What we said, because we wanted to prove a certain principle in terms of taking matter to the tribunal without us being settled with costs, we took the matter to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and then we got that matter, we won against the industry. That was a principle that we wanted to test, that says that as a regulator, when we go before any other court, we are not doing it for our own benefit. We are doing it for the benefit of the consumer. And as such, the Supreme Court of Appeal stood by us and said that a regulator cannot be settled with a cost if they lose a matter, either at the tribunal or they withdraw a matter. So this is how we go about in terms of this practice when we are looking for this directly. So we don't make it scholarly. It becomes within our ambit in terms of the practice of the provision of the Act. Now, when you're looking at outcome number nine, here we are looking at consumer awareness initiative conducted. Here is where we workshop with consumers and also workshop with consumers. Could it be in a workshop? Could it be through explanation? And sometimes as well, it's working when we go with the DTI through the INBIZO, wherein we bring those services to the people and we allow them to also file complaints. And on output number 10, we're looking at compliance initiatives. Here, when we educate businesses, we just don't see it as just only mere education. We also, when we teach them, we actually make it easier for them to comply, because we'll say to them, this is what you do when you put a label out. This is how you do when you display a price. So we don't get punitive most of the time, but we will go out and say, this is how you do things, so that it makes it easier for them, especially for the smaller suppliers, to comply. And also we would publish or distribute educational material to both your suppliers and also your consumers in our newsletter that we will also share at times with our counterparts within SADC and also within Africa. So that is what normally talks to the our performance plan. I am going with the chairperson around the floor. I said that we had a budget of 55 million, 34.6 million. We use it on remuneration because we are labor intensive, and 22% actually we use it for our project. So I am going to head over now to our acting CFO to actually take you through the budget so that we can do that better. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the select committee. The Deputy Commissioner has already touched on certain of the key elements of But taking into account that we've got 22% of our operational budget available for your core expenses, being all the goods and services that you require, it is essential that your budget allocation as well as the related spending are directed towards the achievement of your core functions and programs as it is reflected as strategic objectives earlier in this presentation. The entity has four programs which are in line with the four groupings of strategic objectives as was discussed now, and they are indicated from page 19 onwards up to page 21. Obviously, where the most activity is taking place, your compensation of employees will be higher because that is where the majority of the staff are situated. If you look over to program of page slide 21, on the administration, the budget of the entity is to a large extent still centralized insofar as your services that are shared amongst the whole of the entity are rendered and where the expenses thereof are allocated towards your administration program. And it also covers there your support services such as ICT, HR, finance, supply chain, and facilities. On slide 22, I must also put you in context in respect of the spending as it is reflected here. Of the operational budget, that is to say for goods and services, 25% of that budget is available for specific projects and new services, etc., whereas the majority, around 75% of the budget for goods and services, are of a recurring nature. That is to say that we pay every year certain fees for auditors, you pay certain legal fees, you pay for your maintenance of your systems and your finances, and basically all types of other expenses that are of a repetitive nature. So, but just to draw your attention to the fact that given the nature of consumer protection and the related services, your major cost drivers are obviously in terms of your administrative fees and your advertising, where your focus would be on marketing and awareness sessions. Also, in respect of auditors, there is a reasonable high amount that goes towards internal audit fees as well as for auditing by the Auditor General. Consultants and contractor services relate mostly to the maintenance and the support of your financial systems and the entity's contact center. And then other cost drivers are typically your legal fees, where there are costs associated with the consumer tribunal, as well as other legal actions that the entity is involved with, and then also your travel and subsistence and venues are also some of the items that are also in support of your of the execution of your core functions, because that is where you find your inspectors traveling and the awareness sessions and consumer education that is taking place. On your slide 24, your assets and liabilities, there is not very much to say other than the fact that we are now only 2 months into the new financial year, and as such, your assets and liabilities that are reflected here are basically based on previous year tendencies, but it also makes provision for your accrued expenses. That is to say that you have services at the end of the year contracted and invoiced to the entity, which were at that stage in the process of being processed, as well as provisions, that is to say for your leave provisions, your workmen's compensation contributions, etc. Regarding slide 25, where we look at the cash flow of the entity, we are expected at the beginning of the year 50% of the budget by means of a first tranche, and thereby securing that we have enough funds in the bank account to meet the operational expenses until mid-year, when there will be a further 2 tranches in paid of 25% of the budget. And then finally, just in respect of the budget, our budget comprises mainly the budget allocation from the DTI that we receive. There is a small amount that the NCC obtains from investments that are kept with the monies in our budget monies that are lying in the bank accounts and that are invested on the of investment in the corporate or the public sector specific account where we are then generating some revenue. So as such, the entity's budget is very tight, and yeah, the discretionary part thereof is made only up about 25% of our available funds, as mentioned earlier. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all that I have at this point.
Thank you, Shane. I think we are done.
Thank you very much, Acting Commissioner Mabuza. Honourable members, there we have the presentation. Let me, this time around, because I don't get the chance once I have given it to you, let me start off with a few comments and a question. The first is, we note with appreciation the relationship that you have with the tribunal. The tribunal has reported to us earlier this year on some of the work that they are doing and many of the challenges because of the type of society and economic system in which we find ourselves, so we appreciate that. My first would be to raise a question on a matter that I read in the media you have been working on and also picked up in the study group. Can you tell us how far have you gone related to the matter of ETCIS and the extra charges that they and some other retail companies levied on people? I spoke to somebody over the weekend who told me that she is paying an insurance policy, life insurance of ETCIS. Is this a matter of the, let's raise it so that we can advise our constituencies on that. That's the first question. The second, can I ask you to give us just a synopsis of where we are with Ford and Kuma, right, so that we can put that behind us. The third one, I don't know if other members have experienced this as well. You go to a bank, and the person helping you at the bank will tell you that I can't give you financial advice. But we know if you walk into any bank now, you find that there are long queues of people for personal notes. And I'm worried, how do we protect those vulnerable people in the situation of high unemployment and big debts? Now, I don't want to raise it with the National Credit Regulator, but then just on your side, maybe to say, are you working with the NCR on that? Whose responsibility is it? And what you find then happening is that some people, because of ignorance, then incur major debt because the official in the bank would say, I can't give you financial advice. So, sorry, at the top, whereas you need to go to a special consultant, and many of the people don't know that because we have a growing middle class who is very often not aware of what the consumer rights are in that sphere. The last two questions that I have, the one is a request. On the newsletters, can I ask that you send to the office of the Parliamentary Liaison Office, to study Saraoja's office, copies of the newsletters so that we can have an insight into that? Can I say that if we have 20 copies, that would suffice members? 20 copies of the newsletter. They bring out 4 newsletters per annum, so it's 3, I mean, at least one every quarter. Okay. Then Saraoja will pass that on to us in our regular meetings. My final question. You did say that you are not really falling within all the legislative requirements of the Department of Government. And I noticed that you have an accumulated surplus of about 8.9 million rand. Now, normally, if you're a government department and you have a surplus, you can't roll over. You have to give it back to the Treasury. I just wanted to make sure that, indeed, you are within your rights to then, because I see the interest that you have in your accounts as well, that you are within your rights to use that surplus in a way that is prudent for the NCC. Let me stop there and hear if there's any of the other members, Honorable Pava and Honorable Tikhale. We'll take both of them in sequence and then give you a chance to respond. Please, Honorable Pava.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation as well. Sorry for that. Yes, firstly, I would like to know how do you actually market yourself to the consumers? Because I know myself, a lot of consumers have no idea if they have problems how to actually get to you. So the marketing to have people known about you so that you can actually follow up cases. I don't really see advertisements going out a lot, so this is the first thing. The second thing I would like to, or issue I would like to talk on, is on data costs. I know there was something on Vodacom at some stage on data costs, but I would like to know why have you not, up to date, been able to work on data costs in South Africa? As I know, we are one of the countries paying the highest for data over the world. You can go to any country, you can actually get data for much cheaper. And as you know, being able to use data is being able to encourage people to learn. And this is specifically in our country, I think, one of the things to teach people and giving them education, and data is part of that. Then we obviously followed, as Honorable Makuwe was saying, on Koga, or on the Fort Kuga, I'm saying Koga, Fort Kuga, as well as the listeriosis outbreak, the timeshare hearings. Now, on the timeshare hearings, you're saying that the cost, the court said that you don't have to pay the cost. But did you win the case, or this is the other thing? Because it is saying that, yes, the court said we don't have to pay the cost, but did you then win the case, or did you still lose the case? This is the one question. And then with this listeriosis outbreak, the Department of Health, I need to understand, when is it the Department of Health taking it forward? And then subject matter experts. When you go on listeriosis outbreak, for instance, because there was a lot of stories on that, and it was it Enterprise, was it these people? Do you really have subject matter experts? Because these things can end up in court, and at the end of the day, the taxpayer has to pay it when we lose those court cases. So my question is, on the Fort Koga, listeriosis, do you have these experts? Because if you have a rollover, really, you can start paying for the best experts so that when you go to court, that you really have a watertight case. That is just the questions for now. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Tikhale, you'll come after Honorable Tikhale.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Let me take this opportunity and thank the Center for a powerful presentation. We could hear that it's Imbogodo who is doing the presentation. Mama, your vision says to be the leading institution in consumer protection that is professional, responsive, and effective. But then when you go to page 7, what you're saying about the key focus when it comes to investigation is then clashes with the vision. Because you're saying the NCC is unable to investigate every consumer complaint. So now my question was that
If you are unable to investigate on every consumer complaint, then how are you then going to encourage those who have queries to keep on bringing their complaints to if you're failing in this on this one? The Honorable Faber touched on the issue of listeriosis, but then I was going to bring it back in such a way that you must just try and encourage your consumers to keep on reporting. Because if you don't investigate each and every complaint, then sometimes they will just arrive in a confusion whereby they say, no, 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 no. We keep on complaining and reporting, but we don't see any good results. So the other one, well, the Honorable Faber touched on two of my things that I wanted to raise. But then I want to say, in addition, that how do you then arrive in the level of awareness when it comes to especially the people that are staying in the rural areas? Mm-hmm. Because what I know is that life is in the urban area or in the town. And it's not everybody who can afford to move to town. But then wherever they are, they are supposed to also be encouraged to live in the areas that they are living. Then my other question is that we have too many shops in our rural areas where we are staying. And one could normally see that the food or whatever is being sold in that shop, truly speaking, our kids will grow up eating those stuff, and when they are of our age, then those food will then go back and hunt their health, because we are always saying we are what we eat. How do you assist those shops in our rural areas, whereby if you go to Pick and Pay, you find that there are nice names for the bread there. The company that are producing the bread, talk about Selco and the others. But at home, in our rural areas, we don't have those names. We even give them the name. There's one other bread, very cheap, we call it Fakumoya. Because inside the bread, there's no nutrients, just the egg. You see? So I just want to check as to how do you then end up assisting those people? How do you help when it comes to quality of what we're buying in the rural area? Thank you.
Okay.
I think Honorable Member has touched some of the issues that I wanted to raise on rural areas. I'm from a rural municipality in Gian. There in my municipality, there is this Indian shop, Ethiopian shop, who sells snacks. So once, and they sell it to school kids. Once the kids go and buy that thing, they eat, there'll always be sore in the head. So what we do is that we encourage our kids not to buy those snacks, but those snacks are being sold in school. So I just wanted to check with you whether you also go around and check the food that is sold in those shops, because For my belief, those food is not healthy, and there's nobody who is taking in charge of looking at those issues. So I think you can also just establish a team where they go around and check in the rural municipalities. It's where there's a lot of problems, because our people don't even know where to report it to. They just encourage their kids not to buy, but kids is kids. When you give them 1 rand, they go and buy. Okay. And still, and those things is still in the market.
Thank you very much. Because of the limited number of questions from Omdo Matibula, let me add my last one, which is related to the fourth industrial revolution. We are in this new era of looking at intra-Africa trade as well. Maybe just help raise my awareness with regard to technology, that we have Samsung with their factories in KZN. We have a television manufacturing plant here in the Western Cape as well. And just yesterday, our minister was opening that factory in East London. Now, my question is as two-pronged. The one is, how are you, with your restricted budget, how well are you positioned to be able to protect the consumers also in that space of technological advancement? That's one part of the question. The other is, are you able to give us an indication of how well our South African companies are doing? I know I may have to go to DKI because you're doing more consumer protection. But it's an unfair question, but let me pose this because you are here. How are we positioned as a country as well to be able to beneficiate and participate in that technological space to position our country in this intra-Africa trade environment? Thank you very much. Those are the only questions that we do have for you. And let me look at the time, and we know we're fairly okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. I'll attempt to answer. They are very difficult questions, but I think my colleagues will be able to respond to some of them wherein I would I'll fall short. First, in relation to the surplus in the budget, and as I said, we are, in terms of our accounting system, on the accrual system. So if they make a commitment this year for 3 million, so in our budget, we must be having that 3 million, it becomes a rollover. And then besides that, as well, is that wherein we, it's not in terms of the accrual, what is accrued to pay for that, we still have to surrender some of the money back to the public finance, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. We are on par in relation to that, so there's nothing to decide. It's just our accounting system, which is on our accrual system because of the nature of the business when we actually were established, so that it allows us to run with a certain project. On the first one that I wanted to speak on is around the relationship on around the issues of EDGAR. I'll start with the issues of extra charges, issues of insurance policy, and that also talks to, I had a similar question around the issues of the conduct of the banks and the debit orders over the weekend. There is a new act on the General Financial Act that actually takes out anything that has to do with financial services away from the ambit of the consumer protection. Yes. And based on that is that anything that has to do with your short-term insurances, your anything that has to do with short-term, long-term insurances, the advice that you would get from the bank, it's now within the responsibility of the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, which was the old FSC. But then we are working with them. We are in the same ambit. We normally have what we call a regulator, a consumer protection regulator forum, wherein we sit, we engage, and then we'll package some of the issues together. And then we are also, as the NCC, sitting within what we call an e-commerce forum, wherein we look at issues of your debit orders within the banks and all that, and advise them in terms of the complaints that we get and in terms of the conduct of their people that they are regulating with the banks. And I'm sure that members will remember, before, when you would have a debit order of 99 rand, because that's what would happen, when you will reverse that, you were charged something like 45 rand. But now when you look at that, the charge is around 6 rand or so. So that is that kind of like the interactions that we have behind a closed door, wherein we would look at the complaint and say, but this is undue hardship on the consumer. If every time wherein you charge me 99 rand, I want to reverse, I pay 45 rand. So the bank benefits, but then what about the consumer that's charged the amount? So we do engage on those issues. And around the issue of the EFCON group and around those issues of wherein you had your elderly people that were paying insurance for unemployment and all of that, we picked that up, but then we engaged with the NCR. That's why there was an investigation around that. It's also outside our ambit. If we have such complaints, we'll pass it on to other regulators like your NCR. And then, within the issue, we looked also in our, we are aware of the, this decision that was taken by the High Court to say that there was exclusion on issues of when people are applying for credit and all that. We are aware of that in terms of unsecured debt and all that, but it's something that we can talk to when we engage with the NCR, because it's within their responsibility when it talks to issues, especially around issues of people that are over indebted and all that, so it's outside our ambit. But when we engage around issues of consumer education, we do engage around those issues, even if it has nothing to do with us, because it affects the welfare of consumers for us. And around the issues now, I'm just going to pick up on the first issue around the issue of the timeshare inquiry. Around the issue of the timeshare inquiry members, we withdrew that matter because we knew that when we pursue it, we cannot try it again in the same forum, because we realized in terms of the weaknesses in legislation that there were lacunas within that space. We could not actually really successfully deal with the matter. Hence, we withdrew it because we wanted to go the inquiry route. But then the issue was that business was holding us to account to say that we were unethical, we were this, but that we did not want to spell out our strategy because we knew what we wanted to go to. What happened in the Supreme Court of Appeal is that we won that matter against them in relation to what they wanted, because what they wanted to do was to hamstring us in such a way that as a regulator would not be able to approach any tribunal on a matter if we don't win the case. So that was the principle, not the substance of the matter itself. On the substance of the matter itself, we are done with our hearings throughout the province. The report is there. There are some weaknesses in relation to the legislation wherein somehow it's a kind of like we overlooked some of the legislations that were not brought into the ambit of the Consumer Protection Act, like your Timeshare Act and all that, that were actually left there. And as such, the business model worked in such a way that it actually looked at the loopholes, hence the contracts in perpetuity and all that, but it's a matter that will still present to the minister to do something about that. Around the issue of the Fort Cougar, as you know, the issues were twofold. The first one was around the product recall itself, so that consumers will be compensated. And that, in terms of the recalls are ongoing. But then besides the recall, because we saw that within the complaint itself, there is an element of prohibited conduct, wherein we felt that actually the company would have made available goods of inferior quality, hence the number of cars that we're banning. So we have conducted our investigation. We have finalized the investigation. And as you know, that in terms of business, that sometimes wants to be a little bit cocky when it deals with regulators. We have given them a chance because we are aware, first of all, as the commission being under the Department of Trade and Industry, of the interest in the investment of the country. But we do not want to compromise the safety of the consumer. So we have allowed them an opportunity to say we are done with our findings. Here they are. Make an input before we finalize. So we had a tussle with them around that. And then they wanted to drag it until the end of July because we've given that to them. Our report is finalized it in April, given it to them in April, on the 22nd of April. And then they promised us that they will give us their final input on the 10th of May, and they, on the 11th. On the 10th of May, they wrote us a letter to say that they need more time until end of July. And then we said to them, we are not going to offer them that. We received a letter from them, all those, whatever that they are saying about regulators that we are dealing with, but then we will conclude our report, and we told them that if they are unhappy because they don't want to deal with the substance, we are going to proceed and take the matter to the tribunal. Then they have an opportunity now in exchange of documents, because with the investigation is that you let the person that you are investigating to say that this is my finding and I'm making available to you if you want to make a final representation. So they allowed that to pass them by, so we are concluding it. So we will still now, in terms of our process, we'll still go ahead and take that to the tribunal, and then we'll exchange documents or whatever, and then it's a matter that we know that in this instance we are going to really need the services of senior counsel to assist us, because they've applied the best attorneys and all that, though we know on similar conduct they have already settled in Australia. Same environment, same matters and all that, but with the Australian one is because now they have better resources, because they are both competition and consumer, but we are alone. But when we have matters like this, the same as when we did the timeshare inquiry, is that when we approach the DTI on matters where, in, like as you say, we're having a budget of 3 million, we will approach the DTI, and then normally the DG, when matters are like this, he would actually say, I will make a certain amount available so that they assist us in certain matters. But then it comes everywhere. We wish that it should be a spending budget because of our mandate. But then in this instance, they'll come in and they will assist. And we hope that with this matter as well, that they will look at us favorably, because we would not have the resources for the senior counsel, because it will wipe out our entire budget if it's only 3 million that we have. And then around the issue of the listeriosis, the NCC, in terms of its the manner in which it was established, we were not established to have expertise in all the different terms. Hence now, one of our sections, I think it's in section 55, says that we have to look for standards in other regulations, and then it says to us as given by the Bureau of Standards. But then in this instance, it's with any other regulation. So whatever standards that we apply, when we looked at the issues of our safety in food, we compared ourselves with the rest of the world. We are one of those countries wherein the issue of safety of food is within consumer protection. Most countries will have a separate regulator, which they call it the food agency, that looks only at the issues of food, because there are particular standards that deals with the safety of the factories, how they should operate and all that. But in South Africa, as members would recall, when we dealt with the issues of the red meat labeling, the very same problems that we had picked up during that time, that we lack what we call a mandatory standard around the handling of food within the plant. That is what we have. And if we don't even have it in future, we might still be sitting with the very same problem of something else that will be a foodborne disease that will still coming into the country. And then there is what we have here when we work with issues like this, like especially on around food safety, on the issue of listeria. We depend on the Department of Health and then the Department of Agriculture, because they have the labs to do this, in terms of the Food and Cosmetics Act, which is the Department of Agriculture, to do this. But when it comes to issues of illnesses and pathogens and all that, the Institute of Communicable Diseases, the NICD, normally does that, because they have to test all that. That's why now, even with the outbreak, we were part of the team, both the Department of Trade and also Health and also Agriculture, in working together so that everybody brings in their part. Our responsibility, and I'm sure that I will be talking to responding to Honorable Mukale and Honorable Machabula as well. When it comes to issues of your farmer shops and your small sectors, is that the Act doesn't talk to small vendors, because it was there to make sure that your small vendors will still be able to do businesses. But when it comes to what we call your requirements on the handling of food, it is outside the ambit of the NCC. But what we do when we talk around the issues of, let's say, the chips that you're talking about, it could be that it's issues of your Sudan rate that makes those children, if you don't know, but we know that Sudan rate is banned in food. But then it's where in now when such matters are raised now, we will then say to the Department of Health, we have this issue that is coming up. Can we now target these issues of those next so that we check, we have both the national regulator for compulsory certification, but we also have like UNIMISA that deals with what we call reference material, wherein when we pick up a substance, maybe let's say your ship that we have, we can go back to UNIMISA and say to them, check if maybe these products don't contain any prohibited substance. And then based on that, we as the NCC would have to go back to the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications to actually have a standard around that. But if there is no compulsory standard, we can't enforce it because most of the standards are now conformity standards. It becomes a little bit dicey. But then when we can also do that on a twofold, also when we go down to the province, we also go with what you call your what we used to call your old food inspectors before, which now we call them your environmental health practitioners. They are within the department, your municipalities. So when we go to any other municipality, like last week we were in KZN, so we would now inform your municipality within KZN and say, we are coming to be inspecting now, looking at your sell-by date. For us, it's not about any other product. It's only to look at the sell-by date. And then if we find that, then there, because it's in our act, we can only deal with what is in our act, then if we find that there are goods that have now reached their sell-by date, like especially around your ready-to-eat food now, because we realize that if it reaches a sell-by date, then it becomes problematic because your pathogens start now multiplying. Then those health inspectors will remove those goods and then they will deal with their disposal. So we do not have that competency, but then we work with other partners in doing that. So but we have taken that into heart. We will make sure that at least, because now what we do is, given our resources, we would look at a province and say, in this province on this given day, we will at least we try to make sure that we change our provinces, as we said. For this quarter, we're concentrating on KZN and the Free State. And then we would look maybe in the next quarter at another province and ESA. We will look into the BOPE, and I'm sure we will do that. So, and what also is important is that it's the NCC, actually, we have our provincial authorities in consumer protection that have to be doing that within their provinces. So when we go out as the NCC with the Department of Health, we wrote them in to say, let's look at your hotspot where it is problematic. They will also guide us and say, let's go there and let's go there. But we have taken that to heart. Around the issue of the intra-Africa and issues of trade around where we are, I think from the spirit of the Act itself, by making sure that goods that are supplied to the consumers are safe and of good quality. And we as consumers, when we start demanding that quality, it pushes our businesses to comply with good quality. And as such, it makes, by default, it makes our businesses to be competitive. And then one we had also learned is that because now we are geared for investment, what normally happens is that within a particular good, like let's say with Samsung, when they are producing your LED screens for your TV, I think there is a compulsory standard for that, then they will have to comply with that standard, which is still within the ambit of the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications. For us now, we only take that and make sure that if consumers are complaining in terms of the quality that it permeates within the industry, but we are sure that with that by itself, it actually drives our business to be as competitive and as possible. And around the issues of the TVs, which was very also interesting, is that last year we had picked up, I've forgotten the brand of that TV, wherein they passed out a TV as a 4G, only to high definition and all that, and we picked up from some of the consumers. Some of the consumers are very intelligent. They picked up and tested that TV, and only to find that it is not even a high definition. That TV was recorded, was produced by New Web Company in Lesotho, and then we got that TV off the hands of the consumers, and consumers were protected. So we don't have the expertise, but we depend on some of the consumers and also some of the businesses themselves, because what the Act says is that the manufacturer and the supplier, they are all, in terms of the value chain, responsible. Most of the bigger suppliers, they test the assessment of some of the manufacturers. And if they find that the good is not of good quality, that was the TV, and now we are dealing with the very same issue for step ladders that we are recalling, because one of our suppliers picked up that certain step ladder, when people are climbing on it, it doesn't have good harnesses, they fall, they fall to us, because they could be the manufacturer in question, and then we are recalling those step ladders. So it's those things that our system and the manner in which the Act has been crafted holds everybody accountable, so that we have checks everywhere. But I'm going to pause there and allow my colleagues, if maybe there's some of the questions where I fell short, just to supplement where I fell short.
Honourable Chairperson, members, thank you very much indeed. Just insofar as the last matter that the Deputy Commissioner was dealing with, Chair, on the intra-trade issue. Now, South Africa does have a very strong consumer protection law. We've got very good protection when it comes to our payment systems and so forth. Now, the problem has always been within Africa itself. Now, the Deputy Commissioner chairs at SADC the Committee for Consumer Protection. And what we've been able to do through SADC is to encourage other countries to adopt strong consumer protection legislation. And we've been very frank, and we've indicated that where suppliers are unable to comply with laws in South Africa, or other suppliers from other parts of the world that can't comply with our laws, will be looking to, in some way, dump these goods. And the likelihood is that they're going to go across our borders. And then I think the vast majority of our members in SADC has already started with consumer protection legislation in some instances, checking with us what we have, benchmarking here, benchmarking in the US. So that's starting to gain momentum throughout the continent, even on the northern regions as well. So that's pretty helpful. The one area that we're particularly concerned with is that with that relates to your online shopping. We share that responsibility with ICASA, who's responsible for the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act. It's something that we will be focusing on in time, given the fact that I think online trading has increased, I think, by 10, 20-fold in the last year or so. So that is an area that we should be looking at. There was a question, I think, by the Honourable Farber in relation to data costs. Honourable Chairperson, the National Consumer Commission cannot regulate costs itself, but we do accept that we do pay one of the highest costs in relation to data on the continent. Egypt recently reduced their gig cost by, I think, 2/3, now come down to about 15 rand a gig or so, and that was forced upon them. What our Act does regulate, however, is that, like Deputy Commissioner indicated, when it comes to prepaid data, we basically say that consumers should get value for money, and it should not expire unless 3 years have elapsed, or if that entire data was used up in that particular time, whichever comes first. Now, one of our biggest problems that we have with industry is the forfeiture of unused data in favor of the network operators. We feel it's very unfair. We feel that consumers are not given value for money.
insofar as your post-paid data is concerned, where you have contracts, like many of us in this room probably do, where we have a 24-month contract, we do say that in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, the network provider is supposed to credit you with any unused data at the end of the contract. Now, that is seemingly where we have odds with the industry, particularly with regards to unused data. Now, we've made the presentations to ICASA when they were coming up with their regulations, and what they've done was, I think the only thing that they've listened to us thus far was on the rollover of data. So you now have rollover following the representations that we, the NCC, made today. We haven't been able to succeed on all aspects, but it's something that we will be testing in the tribunal ourselves in the time to come. So we haven't closed the door on that particular issue. And the Competition Commission is looking very closely at that, and we will be, I think, working very closely, Chair, with the Competition Commission on this particular issue. I'm not sure. Insofar as Deputy Commissioner, when you were speaking about the issue that the Honourable Matabula raised, insofar as the headaches school kids are having following the product that they are consuming, I think if NMISA is able to find probably some product that is harmful or some ingredient that is harmful, it's something that we can easily report, depending on what NMISA tells us. You see, I'm not sure if there was anything else that I should be responding to that we may have left out. Yes, insofar as water tank cases, I think there was a concern that Honourable Farber raised, indicating that we need experts. Chairperson, experts do come at a cost. We have a limited budget, but when it comes to legal arguments and so forth, on big matters, we are now starting to engage counsel, senior counsel from the very outset. And in some cases, we don't need senior counsel because the issues don't require senior counsel in that regard. So we choose that pretty carefully to manage that from the very outset. So like in that Supreme Court of Appeal matter, we used a junior counsel that argued against senior counsel. But we were confident when it came to our case, and we were able to succeed on that. So we don't just throw in senior counsel for the sake of it. I think we, Chairperson, unless you indicate otherwise, I think we have covered.
No, I think you have. I think you have.
Chairperson. The Honourable Member is absolutely right that it may appear that we are at cross purposes with our mission in the sense that we cannot investigate every single matter. Now, just to give you an example, when we have the we have the motor industry ombuds, last year they received 7,700, just under 8,000 complaints. Then we've got the Consumer Goods and Services Ombud, they receive just under 6,000 complaints. What we try and do, when you look at the policy that comes out of the Consumer Protection Act, we try and encourage both consumers and suppliers to try and resolve their problems amongst each other first, and if they can't resolve it, then to escalate it to our provinces, and then if that is not possible, to try and use the ombuds that we've been able to help establish, and then finally to come to the NCC. Because there's just too many matters for a small unit to be dealing with. But that being said, Chair, we are not acting in a manner that seems to be
at odds with the way other national consumer regulators operate throughout the world. Now, Deputy Commissioner earlier spoke about looking at trends that emerge and so forth. So what is important is that when we receive these complaints, it goes into our database and we can be able to then track what trends are emerging, where the problem areas are, and what sort of interventions we can probably put in place. And that is the way most international consumer protection regulators operate. Unfortunately, we have a limited number of staff. We can't possibly look at every single case. It's impossible.
Thank you very much. Let me add, Honorable Tikhale, whatever has been shared now, we have certain authority as members of Parliament to also say to the NCR that this is a matter that we think you should prioritize. What it means is that we will have to agree on what processes, what mechanisms do we use to get that done. And that is therefore resting with us, how exactly we do it. I know from all the entities within the DGR that when I communicate with them, not as chairperson but as a member of parliament, I find that they are very often listening to us with a different ear than what they would if it's a normal consumer, because they also know that we represent a constituency, so when one raises something, it is because you are looking at a bigger situation rather than just the individual. But I also then just wanted to do the following, to say on the listeriosis matter, you would have noticed that the person who spoke to us on the media was the Minister of Health. So we've had that interministerial committee looking on it. And my hearing of what Dr. Aaron Oshinedi was saying is that they will keep on monitoring what is happening within that space. If we look, for example, at what has happened in West Africa and what is now threatening people in the DRC, what's that?
Ebola.
South Africa is well positioned in terms of our development in science. Okay, we're not far to deal with that. So we are also helping other countries on the continent. But we have the scientists in Pretoria that are adequately prepared to deal with this type of listeriosis type of matters. Just the final request that I have, because you've not mentioned them as such, is can you please, in your marketing, also look at improved cooperation with the National House of Traditional Leaders, because there's great work that they can do in our unequal society of the two colleagues that here. The consumers in the rural areas, traditional leaders can be of great help there. And we have loads of mothers in these rural areas. And if the traditional leader, the chief, knows something, it will be communicated to those people there and benefit our children in those rural communities. The other one that I want to mention, and I notice with appreciation that you mentioned the municipality in but we can, because we just come out of a consultation with the South African Local Government Association, say to you that should you approach the CEO of SOGA to then look at how we can also make effective use of our human resources in the municipality. We are appreciative of the time that we have had this opportunity to engage with you. We are appreciative of the work that you are doing. We know that many of our economic practices do not consider the consumers in a way that respect our profile, and we are therefore even more worried that we can't leave consumers on their own. It is going to be important for us to have an institution like the FCC that would ensure protection for our consumers. Now, in the traditional authority, once the chief has spoken, nobody else is allowed to speak after that. But this is not that. It's a different space. So I'll allow my traditional leader to speak.
Thank you, Chairperson. I could hear that you're concluding. That is why I want to come in. I wanted to make a follow-up. I have heard that they sometimes receive 80 or even more thousand complaints. So my question was that why do you allow the complaints to, I don't know how I can put it clearly, how do you allow the complaints to reach that type of a number? Instead of, I have noticed that you're talking millions here. 5 and 4 million that you're receiving in your I don't know whether I should call it a department or what. Why don't you at least have a group of people that will have a share on this money every month so that whenever the complaints arise, then they tackle them at once. So that at the end of the day, we will then be able to say, indeed, you are prioritizing safety to your consumers. So only that one that I wanted to talk.
Can we give you a chance to respond?
Chair, we really appreciate that for the guidance in terms of using the traditional leader and also the use of SALGA. It's an area that we will really look into. Those that we've really tried, but we are going to try again so that we get their preparation and support. And I think before the DTI had the very same team, we were able to disseminate some of the information with them, so we will try again. And then around the issue of the complaint handling, what the Act says, because we have concurrency with the provinces, the role actually of the MCC is not to intervene on one-on-one complaints, because in every province we have a consumer affairs office that has to deal with the complaints within their province. What we normally would get, it will be like, let's say, we were dealing with the Vodacom issue around now the increase, unilateral increase of prices. What the provinces would do, if they would get 5 or 7 matters of similar nature, what we would normally do is then we will check with the other provinces to say that, did you also in Limpopo get the very same complaint in KZN? And those matters become what we call systemic matters. Then we will say to the provinces, bring all those matters to us, escalate all of them to us, then we deal with them. But the responsibility of dealing with those one-on-one is for them. But then, as maybe my colleague has said, the Act by itself gives a hierarchy. First of all, if a consumer has a problem, the first port of call is to go to the supplier, resolve it. And when we are looking at what we call the Code of the Consumer Goods and Services Conduct, it actually says to most of our suppliers to say that if you go to a particular store and there is no resolution, then the head office of that company should take that matter up. That's why we say until it's exhausted at supplier level. If that has been exhausted and then the consumer is not yet happy, we also have another level. The level will also be what we call an ombud within that sector, like the motor industry ombud, wherein if they couldn't resolve that matter, then it comes to us. But when the policy of the DTI that led to the Act was being done, is that most consumers, they do not want this protracted system of dealing with complaints. If somebody complains about a loaf of bread, all that they want is a refund or a loaf of bread. So that is how the system is. And as such, when we are dealing with a consumer complaint, we try as much as possible that in dealing with, because most of the complaints that you will get, it will be somebody that complains about a refrigerator that they bought at Gain. And then you will find that just the mere issue of investigating that, the cost becomes so prohibitive for us to spend $10,000 to get a resolution of a complaint of $4,000. So as such, what we will do is on matters like this, we will be looking at now, when we get a complaint, let's say of Gain, we will check, do we have any other matters of Gain in our system? If we do, then when we approach Gain, we will be approaching Gain and say, we have seven matters. The seven matters that we have is that you do not replace goods on time, you do not adhere to your contract test, let's say in delivery and all that. So we club them together so that it becomes easier for us to deal with an entity that then address a multiple. So, and as far as you say, because of the concurrency, we can't deal with all of them, I think is what my colleague has said. But when it comes to the investigation, because it becomes a process, it becomes costly, we look at matters where we want to do case law and where we want to deal with principles, but then there are other agencies that by the